Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're back talking to. It's like we just go after the mayors, Martin. What's that all about? It's like a collection. Every time there's a new Lord Mayor, quick, get them.
We have to be fair too. I mean, the Lord Mayor is a prominent position, particularly in Dublin politics. So I think we have to be fair about that as well.
I agree. I would love to see, and I think we might ask the question in a while about maybe the idea around a directly elected mayor, where we go from there. But in the meantime, Labour are on the up. Ivana Bacic has won the seat in Dublin Bay South, and I mean a lot of people think it was the best candidate in the best location, really worked well. But I have to say I'm about to speak to the new Lord Mayor of Dublin, Alison Gilliland, who's also of the Labour Party, and just 2 weeks in the job. Alison, how are you keeping?
Very well, thank you, and great to be chatting to you again. Yeah, I was elected this night 2 weeks ago, and literally hit the ground running. An hour after I was elected, I was sat down by the staff here in the Mansion House with my schedule for the next day and the keys to the house. So it's been like that every single day. It's great. It's a great honour. It's a great privilege to be in the role and to promote the city, but also I think I'll be allowed to promote some of my own projects, which will be gender, housing, and how the city is going to transition out of COVID into a more sustainable city centre and surrounding.
I think that's I have seen some of your comments, and look, I've spoken to you previously. I kind of know the colour of your money and where you're coming from, and I appreciate that. But the idea of Dublin post-recovery, do you want to just lay out for listeners just what somewhere what your vision is and what you want your term to be about?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we saw during COVID, particularly during the lockdowns, was the imbalance in the city centre, particularly with regard to the lack of people living in the city centre to keep local businesses, whether that be coffee shops or just the news agents going. People come into the city to work, and a lot of the time they might spend Friday night after work, drinks, and then they go back to where they reside themselves. And like my local community, no more than your local community, began to thrive with everybody working from home. But the city centre really, I think, fell on its knees. As a Lord Mayor and working with the City Recovery Task Force, I suppose our role is to try and right that imbalance, but also try to help businesses become more sustainable. The whole idea of outdoor dining, pedestrianisation, can we make the city more family friendly for those who want to come in and enjoy it, but also for those who might consider living here longer term? So that's part of what I'd like to do.
It kind of reminds me of when I was working in London and the part of the city I was working in up around Wimpole Street. At the weekends and in the evenings, everything closed early. I mean, the pub around the corner closed at 6 o'clock. Everybody went home and it was deserted. And Bank, you know, if you get off at Bank Station, it was the same. It was that it was just a business district. Nobody lived in it. And it was a very underused but very beautiful part of the city, which was a terrible, terrible pity.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we have to a certain extent, particularly on the south side of the city. You would have more residents living in the north side of the city compared to the south. And one of the things we're doing here at the moment, the round room next door to me is having an exhibition opening on Monday, running through to the end of August, and it's open until 8 o'clock in the evening. So we're trying to promote that as a cultural event that is open later than, you know, normally they close around 5:30, 6, to see if that sort of idea of, as you say, allowing things, particularly cultural events and our national museums and galleries, open later, so you have something to do that's not the pub in the city, and that might encourage more families, particularly, or even individuals who want to wander around the city and do something after work, particularly if you're living in the city, you want to have those activities on your doorstep.
Yeah, I think there has been an idea, obviously discussed several times, about no pun intended, the nightmare, but that has been discussed. But I think that's in keeping with some of this kind of I mean, I'm old enough to remember no Sunday trading, and you could play football on Henry Street, you know. But it was different then, and obviously some of the hollowing out of our city has taken place, and it's been accelerated over the period of COVID. Just in terms of what we've seen, some of the other things in terms of tempting people back in, unfortunately, retail's not gonna do it. That's not the answer now.
No, it's not. And like one of the things, we had a meeting, myself and the director of the City Recovery Task Force with Dublin Town last week. And there are vacant units. Like we've ground floor vacancies that used to be retail, but then we have the perennial problem of vacancy over the shops.
Just going to interrupt your podcast there. This is us with the begging bowl. We have to come with the begging bowl because that's the only way we can keep this project going. The Tortoise Shack gives a lot of information to people. People see it as a public service, but we do need money to keep it going. Just a few things we've done this week. We had Sam McElwenny and we had Emma D'Souza on Sunday, where we had the best chat you're going to hear about the 12th, bonfires, burning flags. You're not going to have a conversation that good anywhere else. What do you think, Tony?
I wish we didn't have to do these pods or these plugs so often, Martin. That's what I wish. There are thousands of people listening and they see value in it, but we need people to actually go one step further and put their hands in their pockets and actually invest in it. I was thrilled the other day. I don't know if you saw, Martin, on social media, Anne-Marie Quilligan saying that she doesn't subscribe to the Tortoise Shack. She invests in it. And it meant the world to me, because things like that, that's what it's about. We are literally hand to mouth. I mean, if we're going to talk in economic terms, Martin, we're in recession, mate.
If we were going to talk in economic terms, we wouldn't be doing this, Tony. Let's be quite honest about it.
That's the facts. And it's unfortunately, it is unviable, except for the fact that we bloody love doing it. And we love the fact, I mean, the listenership has grown exponentially over this entire period. We've put out an average of 14 podcasts a week. Now, I'd say 9 of them at least go out for free. A lot of them stay behind a paywall or whatever the situation is. But if you want us to keep going and having those conversations, it doesn't happen unless people support it. It has to be supported.
So before I let you go back to your podcast, this is it. patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Sign up. It's cheap as chips for what you're getting. It really is. Sorry for interrupting your podcast. We'll let you get back to it now.
There are vacant units. Like we've ground floor vacancies that used to be retail, but then we have the perennial problem of vacancy over the shops. But with regard to the ground floor, what used to be retail, the idea that we floated with them is, could we possibly have a temporary use of that for a pop-up cultural space, a pop-up artist space, and trial those ideas. And I completely agree with you. Retail is not coming back the same way it is. People have got used to shopping online. And I think there's also the environmental consciousness is now gaining a foothold, in that we don't have to be out buying something every weekend. We can have experiences that are more cultural or recreational. And I think that we need to plan for that, and we need to transition. And some of the vacant retail spaces we could use for that to allow us to do that.
And one of the problems with the vacant retail spaces is upward only rents. And that has also now transferred into the housing market, particularly in the city where the apartments have been bought up by vultures and rents are upward only. Any thoughts on that, Alison?
It breaks my heart that people cannot afford to live in the city centre. And you're so right, Martin. Like we have apartments down in the Docklands that are vacant, and they won't reduce the rents because they know if they do, then they're caught with the 4% the max that they're allowed. So it's better apparently on their balance sheet to have them empty than it is to reduce the rent. Same as the commercial. And, you know, that again is working against us. And it's that whole, I suppose, the commodification of housing that has really taken a hold, not just in Dublin, it's in cities around the world. Unfortunately, our national policy isn't allowing us to break out of that. And that's one of the conversations I've been having through the housing policy committee and the public housing working group over the last 2 years, that idea that we need to have a public housing policy that allows anybody and everyone, regardless of their income, the size of their family, their position, whether they work or not, to be able to rent affordably off either their local authority or an approved housing body, something like that. You know, part of me says that we should be buying up all those blocks and converting them into affordable rentals so that we can create the sustainable city that we really need to have.
And Tony will know the figures better. There's room between the two canals to build how many homes?
Oh, look, I mean, if we take it back a couple of years, I think it was 44,000 units in terms of.
And that's on sites. Public land.
State controlled. It's a broad thing. Whether it's owned by controlled by county councils or NAMA or loans that have fallen into under the state's remit. So it's within state control. And it's funny because we see it again with the glass bottle site and, you know, the talk of what's happened there. I mean, Alison, you've been around and you know, this is the third time we've had a crack at the glass bottle site, you know, and by the time this rolls around, I argue that it will be the most expensive social housing project in the history of the state because we've you know, whether it was the Dublin Docklands Development Authority, whether it was through the Anglo purchase into NAMA, and then we're cycling back through a developer model, we've now effectively paid for the same thing on three or four occasions. Just so for give listeners a benefit, Alison and was one of the people who was working closely on the Oscar Traynor Road site, for example, and you know, credit where credit's due, did great work in terms of even convincing the likes of Fianna Fáil at the time that the deal similar to what was being done in O'Devney wasn't the deal they wanted to put through on this one. And we won that vote, Alison. And I know you were one of the people driving that. If you could just maybe broaden that out for the benefit of listeners, what that might mean. And because I'm sitting here now and I know down the road, opposite on the canal, there's a new where the old Baker's Mills are on the canal in Shandon. It's all built to rent, Alison, and that's where the problems are. It's all built to rent, and all those people who might want to have their first home or an opportunity to do something within Phibsborough, within walking distance of this 15-minute city we hear so much about, are facing these rents and these REITs.
Yeah, what we tried to do on the Oscar Traynor is looking at as public lands and how can we maximise the public use of that and particularly retain the units in our stock. Because one of the reasons as to why we have such long housing waiting lists is throughout the years, we have sold off a lot of our stock under the tenant purchase scheme. Now, I know it worked for a lot of areas, allowed to bring that sort of income balance and that tenure balance into an area. But it's got to the stage now where we weren't looking at the long term. And we have about 10,000 families, you know, who are dependent on the private rental sector and are waiting way too long to get that permanent home. And by permanent, it is both from an affordability perspective that the rent is reflective of their income, but it's the secure tenancy. And that is something that renters don't have. And when we see the bill to rent, one of the big questions we have is, like, aside from the rents, which we know aren't going to be affordable in that it won't allow you to save if you want to buy or to have just that flexibility, it's the long-term security. You know, there's no sense of being able to settle if you want to have a relationship and a family without that fear that one day your rent increase is going to be beyond your income, or for some reason they might want to sell on that you have to leave. And I think that's the contradiction in our policy, whereby there's a lot of promotion around home ownership. We want people to own their homes. I have no problem with that. I do think we need to, I suppose, discuss, and we have done this in the Public Housing Working Group, to what extent we use public land for affordable purchase. Because if you're looking long-term into the next generation, we are going to run out of land, and it's only going to be vulture funds that own all of these units, and then they control the markets, and they will control people's lives with regard to putting a roof over their heads.
Another thing you're passionate about is Dublin post-pandemic. And I suppose the big question about that is, are we actually post-pandemic?
No, I think we're going to be another, at a conservative estimate, another 6 months with restrictions, with people, you know, feeling that we still need to be careful. Like, they're talking today about the resuming indoor dining. Like, I know I won't be indoor dining anytime soon. I just don't feel it's a safe environment. I don't hear anybody talking about ventilation. Anybody talking about we only should have X amount of people per square meter in this. And I'm very concerned about the staff. You know, if you're going to be working a shift that can 3-4 hours and you're going to be in that environment with people and a turnover of people, and you're a young person, you have a mask and you're not vaccinated, you know, what about those young people? And I don't think enough attention has been put on the bigger picture. There's a massive lobby there from the Vintners Association and the restaurants. And I think we're missing the holistic piece about the customers and particularly the staff.
I think that's all really fair. I have to say, I think it's all really fair that we are being played, and play is probably the wrong word, but there are lobbyists in, and they are very effective at what they do. But I would also say that on the flip side of that, there seems to be a rush. I mean, there's also a human rights issue. I mean, we speak to Liam Herrick from ICCL, the Irish
Council for Civil Liberties.
Irish Council of Civil Liberties, apologies. And we speak to Liam and Doreen regularly, but they speak about this from a human rights. I mean, it is ultimately a two-tier system that we're looking to impose in some of this. And I see there's a rush even this evening to say, well, you know, we're trying to get this through. Cabinet trying to sign it off. People are unhappy. And it just... First of all, I don't know if it actually will ever come off. And I know, Martin, you've been cynical of it all the way along. But it just seems to me that from a data protection respect, how is this monitored? It's a lot to ask a restaurant or a bar to say, you know, how do we register these people? What do we do with their data? And then on the flip side, it's discriminatory against people who haven't been vaccinated, because who probably want to be vaccinated. And even now with the rush, this is me on a rant, so apologies, but even people on a rush now to get, say, the Johnson & Johnson one-shot vaccine and they get it, it's not as effective. It doesn't stop them actually spreading the Delta variant. They can have it and it can be passed on. So it does seem ill-taught.
I think what they were trying to do, if you remember back this time last year when we were reopening, they have now put the restaurants indoor dining in with the pubs indoor drinking, because of the whole debacle last year where the Vintners Association kicked up. And I think it's the restaurants who would normally be very good at spacing among tables. You know, you eat and you drink, but you don't stay on to drink some more, which we know is when the inhibitions fall and people get close to each other. And I think they were trying to, you know, not be hard on the pubs again. And you can see the contradiction where you can eat indoors in a restaurant and have been able to do that since early June, and yet the restaurants can't. So there's a lack of consistency across the board there. And as you say, we're still hearing about Delta, and that Delta is much more contagious than the previous variants. And yet we're pushing ahead. And as you say, we're making a mess of it, to be perfectly honest with you. I think between, are you vaccinated, are you not? If your kids are under 18, they can come in with you. Yeah.
There is sort of a reverting back to this personal responsibility model. And I just heard today one of the representatives saying that people will have to use their own judgment. But my judgment is different to Tony's, is different to yours. So that's not really a solution to the problem. That's more can-kicking, really.
And caught in the middle, you're having young waiting staff probably going to be harassed by, you know, people who really want to bring their family in, and they don't know where this ends from a legislative point of view. You mentioned the whole GDPR and your data, because that was an issue this time last year where you had to give your name and your phone number if you were going into a restaurant, and you're going, where's that piece of paper going to be retained? Because, you know, if there was somebody had COVID, you're going to have to go back and do the contact tracing. Yeah, there's a lot of thinking, I think, still needs to be done.
Alison, we could talk about this for a while, and I have to say, you know, I appreciate you've been so forthright with us, but I would like to move on to, again, your term as mayor and talk about, you've spoke about gender equality and about some of the things that you're passionate about. What does that mean? What does that look like? And what would be your ambitions? What would you like to see happen during your term?
Yeah, I suppose one of the things I've always experienced is women role models. And I said in my speech the night I was elected, like, if you don't see it, it's hard to be it. And like, I'm only the 10th ever female Lord Mayor in 353. But even if you look just in the last 50 years or, you know, 100 years, women still aren't coming up to those key positions in politics. So by being a woman, I know I'm a role model for other young girls and women who want to get into leadership or want to get into politics. So that's one element of it. And then I suppose through the role of Lord Mayor, it's, you know, promoting women's issues, working with women's refuges on domestic violence. One of the things I'm looking at with our head of finance is, can we gender-proof our local authority budget? And by that, I mean, look at how we spend our money, and is it going to amenities and facilities and services that perhaps are more used by males? And I'm thinking sports, recreation and all that. There's always been a fight about, you know, can we have a space for dance classes, which tend to be taken up by females, not always. And facilities for football, we've an absolute explosion of young girls playing football. And a lot of the time, there's nowhere to change. There's nowhere to go to the toilet. Lads have done it up against the hedge or the wall, which is not acceptable either. But girls just can't do that. And we're seeing them falling off at sort of 10, 11, 12, when they become more conscious. It's that sort of thing from a gender perspective, but also minorities. And I know the former Lord Mayor Hazel Chew did an awful lot to highlight the race inequalities and exclusion in our city. And I want to continue that on. And also those inequalities and exclusions that our LGBTQI plus community also feel. Today I was talking with our chief engineer, asking him if the pride flag that we have put on some of our pedestrian crossings or some of roads, can we do that and maintain that year round? That visibility is not just for pride, it's the year round, and that sort of gives a very strong message that we're an inclusive city.
Yeah, I all of that is, you know, again, particularly so young women participation, it does fall off. There's no question in terms of sport participation, and it is something that needs to be addressed. I think it's also a societal thing whereby dad is okay if little Dave goes to football and maybe doesn't, but nonetheless, and I say that as a father, that need to be engaged with that as well. But I think it's important that the facilities are absolutely there, and I think you're right to point out some of the stereotypical barriers that have fallen the last, like, we only have to look around the Dublin city centre and see some of our best female boxers are coming out of the area now in the last little while.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it's, you know, we need to engender that spirit, and I'm sure our LGBTQI plus community will be delighted to hear that's a focus. But I think we need to move beyond tokens as well. Can I ask, in terms of I touched on it already. What's your feeling on the actual Lord Mayor? Should Dublin, I know Limerick is looking at a directly elected mayor, has had unsuccessfully tried previously. What do you think in terms of Dublin and that having an actual more power reside with the office?
Yeah, I was reading in yesterday's paper about the what the role in Limerick will actually entail. And I wouldn't be overly confident that it's what we sort of envisage when we look at the Lord Mayor of London and other cities where they actually do have power. It has to be much more than that. We have an incredibly weak local government system. Like we depend, we've no fundraising powers at all. We're dependent on grants from the department. You know, even when it comes to housing, we can't develop a housing policy that contradicts national policy, even though the majority of the councillors would actually disagree with it. So unless we actually revise and review the powers, particularly from a capacity of like being able to hire staff, a money raising facility, your mayor, your Lord Mayor, whether elected like me for 1 year or directly elected by the people, is not going to work the way we want it to work. It's all about that authority, the local authority control, ability to, I wouldn't say make its own rules, but like, you know, bring in regulations and like, for example, the vacancy issue. We should be able to have a vacant unit level levy. So like, you know, any house or over the shop or whatever that's vacant for more than 18 months, let's say, allowing for probate if it's a private house, we should be able to levy that because, you know, we want it to be brought into productive use, all of that. We can't do any of that. So the role of the mayor is only as effective as the effectiveness of the local authority.
I do want to point out, just for listeners' benefit, if you were to take over a retail unit accommodation, I think it was, again, back to Mel Reynolds and the studies that he's done. He said you would literally increase the stock in the city. I think it's 3 score what the actual housing, and I put this emergency accommodation supply need is. So it's not something, it's not a small amount of stock that is there, that is available. Sorry, go ahead.
One last question from me, Alison. Where it looks like we're going to get some lovely weather over the next couple of weeks. Are we prepared for it? Do we have enough public toilets? Do we have enough spaces that are open for people? Is the city ready for it?
Yeah, I think one of our challenges in the city with regards to pedestrianisation and open air dining is balancing out the residents that live in the city, the cars that need to, and the buses that needs to use our streets. And we've been doing that in Capel Street and Parliament Street. And I know a lot of people would like to see that 24/7, particularly at weekends. But Capel Street happens to be the artery out of the north side of the city if you're going west. And while we do detour the traffic at the weekend, it's very difficult to do that during a working day. You don't want to be inconveniencing business that are only trying to get up back post-COVID. So from that perspective, we're very conscious of it. We've a winterization project that we're trying to get up and running, where we would have some of that outdoor dining prepared, let's say, for less nice weather. And then from the toilets perspective, yeah, I think we should have been quicker off the mark back in sort of early June to get those public toilets up. We have noticed now with the outdoor dining, the use of those public toilets has fallen drastically, because we actually have a daily count of how many people use them. Yeah, I know it sounds mad, but we're very much that. So in the beginning, those 2 weeks where you had no outdoor dining and those premises weren't open, now people are using those. Now we still have Wolfetone Square and the top of Grafton Street are still in use, and to a certain extent in O'Connell Street, but it's falling off. So we do gather the data, we watch what's happening, and we try to be as flexible as possible. one of the things that we're always bound by, and again, national legislation, is the whole public procurement process. It's taxpayers' money, so we have to have some sort of accountability and give people a fair chance to be able to tender for the services that we're providing, including toilet facilities and the city.
I think just if I give one last thing for me, just in terms of going back to my city, because, you know, I get a lot of stick on this podcast, get a lot of stick because I am very pro Dublin. I want to see my city centre vibrant again, and I like the idea of the cultural spaces. I know there's talk of, you know, say a basic income for artists kicking off and the likes of, but the last time we had a recession, Temple Bar was a cultural centre. Now it's a tourist, and then it was, you know, it was totally corporatized. Do you see any value to be added in spaces now that we can do for, in terms of the creative section, the artists, the creators, all of those people?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we're very conscious of what they have lost and how difficult it is for them to come back, that they don't have the ability to put on theatre or to art exhibitions as they used to have. We've just commissioned, I think it's 6 city murals. So we've an artist call out for that. And it's around using that bigger public space. We also have a public realm animation project as well, whereby we're going to get, you might have noticed the light boxes down in Smithfield. We're getting a carousel, we're getting sort of like animals, sort of painted animals around, like sort of, I won't say they're sculptures, but stuff like that, to both include the artists, but also to animate the city centre and those public spaces and make it more child friendly, and particularly to get that balance. It's not just about coming into town for a brunch with your girlfriends, or, you know, a weekend dinner. It's trying to bring the families in and make it a safer, more creative space for them, and use our artists to help us animate that public realm.
Lord Mayor, thank you very much for taking the time to have this conversation with us. It's always nice to chat to the Lord Mayor. And as Tony says, we do chat to quite a few. You know, we do like chatting to Lord Mayors. Looking forward to seeing how your term goes, and wishing you the best of luck.
Feel free to check in with me and see how it's going along.
Make sure, Alison, you will be
sure to do what I'm meant to be doing.
You'll regret saying that. That's the only thing. Like, I was poor, the new Lord Mayor, Kate Nicol up in Belfast, is plagued by me as well. So we're keeping an eye, and we're hoping to speak to a few more over the next while. But we do wish you all the best. As I said, I care deeply about my city. I love Dublin, and I would love to see that it continues in that way. And again, and I do think nice to mention, actually, Hazel Chew's tenure came to an end. I thought she did another great job in the position. So, you know, it's terrific to see two women coming through. And I know from experience, for listeners' benefits, I know from experience, Alison knows her onions when it comes to housing. So that's a positive thing in my book. Anyway, we will stay in touch, and we will keep on top of it, and we will be back. I think we have the. Is it the Minister for Housing, Martin, next, or Paul Murphy next?
We'll have one or the other next.
They're both lined up. I don't know who's first. That's the problem. We will talk to you all very soon, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.